Herzlich willkommen zu diesem Offenbargespräch. Heute haben wir einen ganz besonderen Gast. Unser Gast ist Carl Truman. Er war der Redner bei der Evangelium 21 Hauptkonferenz im Juni 2024 in Hamburg. Und wir freuen uns sehr, dass wir mit ihm ein bisschen ins Gespräch kommen können über seine beiden Bücher, die wir auf Deutsch auch vorliegen haben, Der Siegeszug des modernen Selbst und Fremde neue Welt. Wir wollen ihn aber auch ein bisschen kennenlernen. Und wir werden dieses Interview nur auf Englisch führen. Von daher werde ich jetzt ins Englische wechseln und ihr könnt, wenn ihr das im Englischen nicht versteht, gerne die Untertitel nachverfolgen und so Anteil nehmen an dem, was wir hier besprechen. Carl, thank you for being here. It's a joy having you here in Hamburg in Germany.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, absolutely. And we want to get to know you a little bit because a lot of people have heard about your books, but they might not really know who is this Carl Truman. You came from the US, but you are an Englishman, right?
I am. I grew up in Gloucestershire, which is in the west country of England. It's in the Cotswolds. It's a tourist area for people from Europe quite often. So that's where I grew up, very rural background.
All right. And did you grow up in a Christian home?
No, I first heard the gospel when I was about 17 at a Billy Graham rally in Bristol, which was one of the local cities, and probably became a Christian during my first year of university.
And where did you go to university?
I went to the University of Cambridge, St. Catherine's College, Cambridge, in the far east of England, the other side of the country.
Yeah. And then you went on and got further education in Scotland, is that right?
I did. I went to the University of Aberdeen in the northeast of Scotland, where I did a PhD in church history.
All right. And if I know that correctly, you did not just bring a PhD from Scotland, but also a wife.
I did. I met my wife, Katrina, at the Free Church of Scotland, Bon Accord, in Aberdeen.
Oh, wonderful. You're a father of two and a grandfather of one so far.
Yes, so far. Looking forward to more, hopefully.
All right, we'll see. Carl, so you got your PhD in church history. What was your initial goal with that? Did you want to go into ministry or in teaching?
I wanted to go into teaching. That was my primary goal. And I was very fortunate to get a position at the University of Nottingham in 1993, teaching in the theology department there, teaching the historical courses within the theology department.
And then you moved to the U.S.
Well, I then moved back to the University of Aberdeen. All right. I got a job there teaching church history. And while I was at Aberdeen, I was recruited by Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. So I moved to the United States in 2001.
All right. Interesting year, 2001.
Yes. We arrived just 3 weeks before the attacks on the Twin Towers. So it was a very interesting time, in a bad sense, to be in the United States.
Yeah, and right there on the East Coast where it all happened.
Yeah.
All right. So you taught at Westminster for many years.
16 years, yes.
16 years. And then you made a move.
Yes, I went to Princeton University for a year. I got a visiting fellowship. Where I worked on the books we're going to discuss today. And while I was at Princeton, I was approached by Grove City College, which is a Christian liberal arts college in the west of Pennsylvania, north of Pittsburgh, and was recruited to join the faculty there, which is where I am today.
And that is probably for many initially a surprising move. I've heard from a lot of professors who moved from college to seminary, but you took the reverse direction. Why did you do that?
Number of reasons, but probably the primary one was I wanted to go back to teaching undergraduates. I think the age bracket of 18 to 22 is a very important stage. And when you teach at seminary, most of the time you're giving people better reasons for believing what they believe already. When you teach 18 to 22-year-olds, there's a real battle for the minds going on, and I was interested in re-engaging that.
Well, thank you for doing that. You're a churchman too?
Yes, I'm an ordained minister in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and I pastored a church in Philadelphia for the last 6 years that I was in Philadelphia. I pastored a congregation of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church.
Wonderful. And you're still a churchman, still a member of a church?
Yes, yep, still an ordained minister, still preach once a month round about where I live. Don't have a congregation at the moment, but I'm called to teach at Grove City College. My presbytery have called me to teach at the college.
All right. And you do other ministry at church too, you told me.
Yes, I'm on the nursery roster. So every month or so, I sit on the floor and play trains with the 2 to 3 year olds while their parents are in the service.
That's wonderful. Well, Carl, thank you for giving us a little insight into who you are. Let's talk a bit more about the books and how you even came to write these books. It's not exactly church history. In a way, it's more philosophy, it's more social studies, I trust. So why did you even think about writing such a book? What was your initial reason for even thinking about this?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, methodologically, I see the books standing in continuity with my earlier work on Reformation. My interest has always been in ideas and why people think and behave the way they do in particular contexts at particular points in time. So methodologically, I see a lot of continuity between my work on the English Reformation, on Puritanism, with these books. But certainly the time period and the topic is very different. This book is really about modern history, and it's specifically not about religious ideas so much as the philosophies underlying what we call the sexual revolution of the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. So the reason for the shift, well, there were a number of reasons that motivated me. One was, as pastor, I was aware that the young people in my church thought very differently about matters of identity and sexuality to the way that my generation did. That was very clear a generational shift was taking place. And I wanted to know why. Secondly, the publisher Crossway had approached me and asked if I would write a book on the philosophical sociologist, Philip Reeve, who wrote an extremely important book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, in 1966. And in researching that book, I realized it would be more interesting to produce a book that applied Philip Reeve than merely explained Philip Reeve. The third strand was I was living in outside Philadelphia at the time, and the school district where I was living became the first school district in Pennsylvania, the state in which I was living, became the first school district to bring in transgender bathroom policies. And I got involved in writing a letter to the school board and to the local paper in an attempt to bring public attention to this issue. And so that sort of radicalized me on that front. And what interested me was the reaction to my letter. And that was that so few parents seemed to understand that the transgender issue in particular was going to be very intrusive and was going to affect everybody. It was going to affect the bathrooms their daughters used. It was going to affect women's sports. It was going to affect women's privacy and safety. But nobody seemed to realize that. And I wanted to write a book that would help explain to people why the things that are going on in the broader culture relative to the sexual and gender revolution have massive implications for the way, not just Christians, but the way ordinary people live their lives and experience life.
And that really progressed significantly, even from the time when you started thinking about it in 2017.
Yes, I mean, it's exploded. I had no idea when I wrote the book, I think by writing. So I wrote the book for myself to think through the issues. I had no idea that it would strike such a chord with so many people. And I come to realize that the issue I was writing about was something that an awful lot of people have suddenly become very, very concerned about, precisely because it is such an intrusive problem.
So the starting point for the book was really the here and now.
Yeah.
But then you really went far back.
Yes.
To help us see how do we get to this place today. Can you just very briefly summarize your main argument or, you know, what you discovered?
Yeah, I could. There are a number of strands to the argument. The first thing is, one of the things I wanted to do was demonstrate that the reason for what's happened, the reasons for what has happened, are not of recent vintage. I think the fact that the old way of thinking, let's say, about men and women, about what is a woman, what is a man, the fact that that has disintegrated so quickly can trick us into thinking that the causes of that are recent causes. Mm. One of the things I try to argue in the book, though, is that when something so solid evaporates so quickly, in actual fact, what you have is a situation where the reasons for that evaporation have been building for many, many years, centuries, in fact, that what we see in some ways is the last domino falling, but an awful lot of dominoes have fallen before that. So one burden of the book is to get the reader to realize that, okay, we have these problems that have emerged in the last 15, 20, 25 years, and they've suddenly exploded onto the scene, but we need to realize that the reason for these problems has been building now for not just for decades, but for centuries. Second thing I would say about the book is this. I wanted to get the reader to realize that although the way the problems are presented to us by modern culture tend to focus on matters of sexual morality and gender identity, those are merely two symptoms of a much deeper underlying problem. And the real problem is that what it means to be a human being has been utterly transformed in the last 300, 400, 500 years. That we've seen the slow but steady emergence of a new understanding of what it means to be a human person emerging. Now you might say, well, can you summarize that change? And I would summarize that change in this way. Think of somebody who says, you know, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. Now, 150 years ago, somebody goes to a doctor and says, I think I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. The doctor's going to say, that's a problem of the mind. We need to treat your mind to bring it into conformity with your body. Somebody goes to the doctor and says that today, almost certainly the doctor's going to say, that's a problem of the body. We need to bring the body into conformity with the mind. Now, forget which is right and which is wrong in this situation. Think about what has happened between those two scenarios. Now, quite a lot of things have happened, but one thing we can certainly say is inner feelings have become more authoritative for who we are than they ever have been before. You go to the doctor in 1800, 1850, say, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body. The doctor is not going to give much authority to your inner feelings. He's going to give a lot of authority to your body. Today, the doctor's going to give huge authority, as you do yourself, to your inner feelings. And the big thesis of the book is that what we've seen emerging in the West over the last 300, 400, 500 years is a situation where we give increasing authority to inner psychological states over physical, social, or communal realities. And that shift is a broad anthropological shift of which the sexual revolution and the gender revolution are merely the most pressing symptoms at the present time.
Now, they would say, those from these communities would argue, your observation is probably correct.
Yeah.
And it's good. But you seem to say you think there is a problem.
Yeah.
So can you help us understand why is it problematic? So where have things gone wrong in your understanding?
Well, that's a good point. And before I answer that question, give a sort of bit more background. One of the things I'd want to say is certainly human beings have always had an inner psychological space. Yeah. We, as Christians, or if you're Jewish, you read the Psalms. The Psalms are full of inner feelings. One of the great classics of post-biblical Christian literature is Augustine's Confessions. Yeah. When you read Augustine's Confessions, it's all about what's going on in here. It's a very, we would say, a psychological autobiography. What's interesting, though, about Augustine's Confessions, or what's interesting about the Psalms is this. Those inner feelings are always brought, ultimately, under external authority. Take, for example, I'm going to use in my lecture later today. Take, for example, Psalm 73. Psalm 73 is all about the psalmist feeling bad. The good die young, the old and the wicked live these wonderfully happy lives and depart from this life peacefully. And the psalmist is very depressed and very distressed by this, and to the point where he says, you know, my feet had almost slipped. In other words, I almost lost my faith. Until he says, I went to the sanctuary. And then their end was made clear to me. Now, think about what the psalmist is doing there. He's got these inner feelings that are very real, and they profoundly shape who he is and how he thinks. But then he goes to the sanctuary, and he's confronted with the covenant God. And he sets his feelings under the authority of the revealed covenant God. And so there is an external reality that ultimately shapes or delimits the authority of his inner feelings. Yeah. Now, come back to the question where you would say, well, but these people would say, it's a good thing that we give rein to things. Well, I would say, but you have to have limits. There are such things in society as psychopaths and serial killers. They have inner feelings too. But we say, well, they can't be allowed to express their inner feelings because they will damage other people. And in saying that, we acknowledge there is a there are communal external limits. Now, again, I would press back on people and say, so if you're going to say you can invent yourself, you cannot do that without taking some acknowledgement of external realities. You have to do that. Secondly, I would say, the man who thinks that he's a woman trapped in a man's body, you know ultimately that your body has authority. Because we know that there are certain, men and women can have certain medical conditions that need to be treated differently, depending on whether you are biologically a male or a female. We know that heart attacks present differently in a biological woman to a biological male. Inner psychological convictions don't change that. Yeah. Just because you're convinced you're a woman doesn't mean that pain in your chest doesn't indicate you're having a heart attack. I would extend that to sexuality as well and say, it's interesting, isn't it, that, I'm drawing these statistics from the American government health webpage, that men who are active homosexuals 18 times more likely to develop certain kinds of cancer than their heterosexual counterparts. That seems to indicate to me that the body is significant, and the body is supposed to be used in certain ways sexually and not in certain ways sexually. So I'd want to press back on the people who say, but it's great that we can just be whoever we think we are. I say, no, actually, it can lead to a lot of misery and a lot of suffering, even on your own criteria, before we even introduce the Bible, that can be the case.
And now let's bring the Bible into it, since we are looking at it from a Christian standpoint, and we do understand that there's a very important external factor with God.
Yeah.
And so we cannot find the solution to whatever problem we find in ourselves or in our environment. We can't find the solution in ourselves, because the ultimate solution, the ultimate answer is external and not within us.
Yeah.
I think Al Mohler once put it very helpfully clear in saying that people tend to think these days that our biggest problems are external and the solutions are to be found internally, whereas biblical truth tells us the biggest problem we have is one deep within, where the sin originates from, and the only solution can be found outside of us. So can you give us a little bit of a biblical perspective on where things have gone wrong?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. And I think the bottom line for this, of course, is that we have to understand that human beings are made in the image of God. And that means that has at least two implications. One implication is we have a moral shape. We have moral limits. We are to do certain things and we are not to do certain other things because these things are intrinsically right. These other things are intrinsically wrong. It doesn't matter what our motives are in doing them. They are intrinsically right or intrinsically wrong. And secondly, we have a telos, a moral end. The Westminster Shorter Catechism puts this nicely, man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. When you think about that definition, it's saying, well, man is to move in a certain direction. Where we've gone wrong in the modern age, I think, is we have decided that moral limits and ends are things we can invent for ourselves. And this, in some ways, is where technology plays in, because technology grants us this feeling of power, that actually the moral limits don't apply to us anymore, because the problems moral limits, transgression of moral limits present, are things we can technologically overcome. So where it's gone wrong, I think, is the loss of the idea of human nature as having a moral shape and a moral end. That's traditionally grounded in the biblical image of God. And interestingly enough, we're seeing even among atheists now a kind of acknowledgement of this. Just a little while ago, Richard Dawkins, famous English atheist, says, you know, I'm a cultural Christian. Well, when you get into what he means by that, he means to say, I want humanity to have some kind of moral shape and to have some sort of moral end whereby we can answer some of the big moral questions. Don't want anything to do with God, but I want humanity to have a moral shape. Well, as Nietzsche pointed out in the 19th century, you can either have moral shape with God, you get rid of God, you have no moral shape. You know, Dawkins wants to have his cake and eat it, as we would say in English. So it's that loss of limits and ends, I think, that is so critical.
Yeah, we find this a lot, I think, with even some traditional, nominal Christians who like Christian morals.
Yeah.
But they don't want to have anything to do with the gospel or with God. Yeah. Certainly not with God as presented in the Bible.
Yeah.
But kind of with God who brings in morals that fit their lifestyle.
Yeah, we like God as lawgiver on that level, but not God as gospel. That's throwing that out for all the Lutheran listeners out there. Too much law, not enough gospel.
Yeah. No, exactly. And so we see even some who call themselves Christians who have gone along with kind of this new thinking about identity.
Yeah.
And they're trying to reconcile the two. What are they actually doing? Is that very inconsistent, or is there some logic to what they're doing?
I think there's, in an absolute sense, it's inconsistent. I can understand where it's coming from, because love is a central part of the New Testament gospel message. We're meant to love each other. Christ says, by this will all men know you're my disciples, by the love you have for each other. The problem, I think, is that we live in a culture where love has been evacuated of its biblical content. And love has come to mean affirming somebody so that they're happy. Now, any human being made in the image of God wants other human beings to be happy. We should take no pleasure in being cruel to others. We should take no pleasure in making people miserable. But we must not allow our notion of love to become a sort of empty sentimental cipher. And you'll see this quite often with parents, Christian parents whose children come out as gay or trans and change their minds then. They move from a biblical position to a more modern, compromised position. Why? Because they love their kids, and they rightly love their kids.
Yeah.
And they feel that pull. They want to affirm their children. But the bottom line on that is you cannot have a biblical concept of love without the content that biblical revelation gives to love. And sometimes love is saying no. Sometimes love is warning somebody that they're going down a very destructive path. That is not recognized as love in the world in which we live today, but Christians, I think, need to be very, very clear on that.
Yeah, so we do really struggle with a redefinition of all kinds of words, terms, concepts, and that then leads not just parents, but even Christians generally who live in a changing world where these categories have changed, and they have an increasingly hard time accepting the traditional biblical understanding of humanity, of sexuality, and so on.
Yeah.
So that's where we are. Now, I'm very grateful that, especially in your second book, Strange New World, you help us to look beyond and not just to look at the, it's important to understand where things are coming from, but where do we go from there now? And so do you have some guidance for us as Christians, how to interact with a world that has become even more strange to us?
Well, I think first of all, we need to make sure that our own people are thoroughly grounded in the truth. Each era of church history tends to, well, the task of Christians in any era of church history, of course, is to teach the whole counsel of God. But we know that as we move through church history, different doctrines are peculiarly challenged at different points in time. So we could go to the 4th century. It's the doctrine of God, specifically the relationship between Father and Son that is under challenge. 5th century, it's Christology. How do the two natures of Christ relate in the one person? We could go to the 16th century and say, well, it's really authority and sacraments. And to some extent, you know, flowing from that justification that are the big issues in the 16th century. The big issue in today is, you know, what does it mean to be a human being? We live in an era where anthropology is key. So not only do we need to teach the whole counsel of God, we need to accent how that whole counsel of God gives us a specific understanding of what it means to be a human being. And I think no pastor today should assume that his congregation necessarily get that. You have to teach very carefully on what does it mean to be a human being made in God's image. That has to be taught very, very thoroughly, consistently and continually. So I'm sort of starting by saying, you know, our first priority, the first order of the day is to catechize our own people well at precisely those points where they're going to be feeling pressure from the world around. Secondly, I think the church needs to be a vibrant worshiping community, because the battle for the mind is not just a battle that focuses on arguments, but a battle that also wants to grab the imagination. Worship, the worship service, has to be carefully thought out in a way that impresses on people what does it mean to be a real human being. And thirdly, I think the practical way the church lives Monday to Saturday has to demonstrate what the love of God means to the world around you. Israel in the Old Testament was to be a light to the Gentiles. The way Israel lived her life was to be a practical demonstration of how God had loved Israel. He loved the sojourner Israel, and so Israel was to love the sojourners that came across her path. I think within the church today, we need to realize that a lot of what's going on in the world around us has left a lot of people disconnected and lonely. And I think the church, by being a welcoming, hospitable community, can not only teach the gospel, but can manifest the gospel in the way that it practically operates week by week. Most important of those three things is teaching. Without true teaching, there's nothing. Yeah. I'm a good Protestant on that front. But we must not neglect careful thinking about worship and careful thinking about friendship and hospitality as well.
I would like ask a bit more about these two aspects, worship.
Yeah.
Now, we have a lot of confusion about what worship is, and what does it even mean to think carefully about worship? Now, Jesus has taught us that to worship truly is to worship in spirit and in truth.
Yes.
Can you help us to think about this some more?
Yeah, I think one of the temptations, even among a lot of good, solid Protestants, is to think about worship as the place where we express ourselves. We go to worship to be made to feel good. Now, feeling good in worship is not a bad thing. Yeah. People shouldn't feel bad in worship necessarily. But what we do in worship is not about us performing. Worship is about us being formed. So the structure of the worship service should be such that it is slowly but steadily forming us. Now think about what I was talking about earlier on. I mentioned teleology, I mentioned ends. If you look at the great classic liturgies of the church, from the early church through the Reformation, they're all what I would call teleological liturgies. They begin with something like a call to worship. They contain a confession of sin, a declaration of forgiveness. They end with a benediction. In the Orthodox, Catholic, and Anglican traditions, the evening service, towards the end of the evening service, you have the Nunc Dimittis, Simeon's song. You know, Simeon, having met with the baby Jesus in the temple, is ready to die. Mm-hmm. He sees the end of all things there, and he's ready to die. There should be a dynamic to the worship service that has a teleology to it. So that as we participate in worship week by week, we might say we become part of the drama of the gospel. the rhythm of the worship service actually reflects the rhythm and the pattern of the gospel. And that slowly but surely shapes us. You might say, well, we did that last Sunday and it didn't have much effect. I say, that doesn't matter, because it's only when this happens week after week after week that you slowly but surely get transformed through word and spirit into that which you should be. So the truth of the gospel should actually shape the rhythm of the worship service. Now, that is not to say that everybody should adopt the Book of Common Prayer or whatever, but it is to say that if you're in a less formally liturgical tradition, if you're more free church tradition, you still have an order of worship. Think about how you might structure the order of worship, not to be super rigid, but to reflect that dynamic of the gospel, so that each week your people know what it is to confess sin. They know what it is to have forgiveness declared. They know what it is to depart with the Lord's blessing. These are very, very simple things. And week after week, they will reshape the imagination.
Yeah. And that's really way how teaching meets worship, right?
Yeah, yeah. We don't just learn in the worship service from the preaching. Yeah. You know, the worship service is not just a lecture with some music on either side of it. The whole worship service is part of the teaching process. I like to think of worship services a bit like learning a language. I only have French as a modern language. My languages are ancient, but Latin is my strong language. And you know, I don't recall any particular Latin. I went to a very traditional boys' school, did Latin from the age of 11. I don't recall any Latin class I ever took, but I can read Latin. So I know that over the years that I went to those classes, my brain was slowly reconfigured so that I can read Latin.
Yeah.
Church is like that.
Yeah.
Praise God, sometimes we go to church and something transformative happens on that Sunday. But that's not normal. Mm-hmm. Normally what happens is we are transformed over years and years of the routine of regular worship. It shapes the way we think. It shapes the way we intuit and imagine the world around us.
Yeah. And it's very helpful even hearing you talk about worship. It's very clear that you're not just talking about music, not just about songs.
No.
Which a lot of people today do
yeah.
when they talk about worship.
Yeah.
But even to think about even that being part of the teaching ministry of the church.
Yeah.
So what we sing is really important because that, again, shapes how
yes.
we think.
Yes, yeah. And I'm not here making a point about, you know, contemporary versus traditional
I understand.
On that level, but, you know, I'm making a point about good versus bad.
Yeah.
We can have good contemporary songs, but, you know, what we sing, particularly, you know, words attached to music are very powerful. And Martin Luther knew this.
Yeah.
You know, one of Luther's great innovations in the Reformation is the whole church sings.
Yeah.
And he waits, it's interesting, he calls for a vernacular liturgy in 1520.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't fully implement one until 1525.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives two reasons for that. The first reason is he knows people are being terribly disturbed by what's going on and he doesn't want to push people too fast.
Yeah.
He just wants to get them to where they need to be. But the second reason is he can't get the music right.
Mm-hmm.
He makes the comment, you'll appreciate this as a German, he says, I need German music for a German mass.
Yeah.
He wants music that connects beautifully to the words and impresses on the imagination.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to think, you know, we need to get beyond the battles of contemporary versus traditional, drums versus organ,
yeah.
to that deeper question of the combination of music and words making both good so they appropriately shape the mind and the imagination of the congregation.
And that probably means that we need truly congregational singing
yeah.
and not just performance.
Not performance. We need, as Luther said, the whole church to sing.
Yeah. Amen.
I often think of, there are two things, I've said this many, many times in lectures, but there are two things that human beings do that no other animal can do.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is we can use language. And isn't it interesting that Luther puts the spoken word back at the center of worship in the Reformation? Speech comes back. And the second thing we can do is we can make music and we can listen and hear music.
Yeah.
No other creature, I gather, has the brain physiology to hear music as we do. And Luther puts corporate singing, word and music, back at the center of worship. And that grips the imagination.
Yeah. Amen. Let's move to the third point you brought in, the Monday to Saturday life of a Christian.
Yeah.
So we as Christians should live, you said, with love and holiness in a way that is attractive to the world around us.
Yeah.
Can you expand a bit on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it may look different depending where you are. I mean, things look different in the city to the suburbs to, I live in a very rural area. And they may look different depending on the job you have and the time you have available. But I think central to the Christian life as a form of formative outreach is hospitality. Opening one's home to the stranger. I, as a college professor, one of the things my wife and I love to do is five times last semester, we open our house to students. Either students from the church on a Sunday, or sometimes during the week, we'll do a movie evening, or we'll just have students over for dessert evenings. I think our record was 70 students in one night, or something like that. But at the back of my mind, I always think back to my college days. I remember very few lectures. But I remember the hospitality that professors gave me.
Yeah.
It had a huge impact. And I think that when the Lord says, you too should, I loved you as sojourners, you too should love the sojourner. Mm-hmm. He's pointing to something very powerful there about the witness of the covenant people. Covenant people are to be open and inclusive in the good sense of the word, in welcoming the stranger in. And not everybody has the resources to be super hospitable. Mm-hmm. But the church as a whole, I think, has the resources to do that. And so one of the things that I would want a lot of churches to consider today is encouraging people to be hospitable, to open their houses to people who aren't family members, to have open invitations. I mean, when I invite the students round, I just throw the invitation open to all my classes. I don't say, well, only the kids in the class that I like, only you are welcome, but I don't want you guys there. I don't like anybody. If you're in my class, you can come to my house for dessert. And I hope that has an effect.
Yeah.
That when those from outside see how we live our lives when we're not in church, whether the kids are Christian or not Christian, that has an effect on how they think about the church.
And even as churches, right? We can even open our churches for, meal after service. Everyone is invited. Every guest is invited.
Yeah, yeah.
To show hospitality in that way, and to say, first-time visitors, strangers are welcome.
Yeah, it's very, very simple. And when you think, when the Lord is saying, I love this, you sojourner, so you should love the sojourner. We can often overthink things. How am I going to develop all these arguments against transgenderism in order to address this issue? Well, the Lord doesn't say to the people in the audience, master the theology of the Philistines. Yeah. So that not that that would necessarily be a bad thing, but he's like, be hospitable.
Yeah.
Sometimes arguments are not the most powerful thing in our arsenal when we're addressing those with whom we disagree.
And I find this very, very helpful and really important for our listeners to hear and understand that while we want to be equipped with truth, so we need to know our truth well.
Yeah.
What the world needs from us is not, first of all, that we tell them everything they're doing wrong or they should do differently, but to just love them and help them to see that our God really makes a difference in our lives and makes us into people who truly love. And with that, we don't mean that we give up truth or that we twist truth and mean love is not ever saying no, we love in a different way. So I appreciate you pointing that out.
Yeah, and I think it's important there to remember, we all have different gifts in the church. I've got friends who, I remember a colleague at the seminary, he could walk into a bar, walk up to somebody at the bar, tap them on the shoulder and start talking to them about Jesus. That's not a gift I have. But I can open my house for hospitality. I think it lifts the burden. Not everybody has to be good at everything. The church as a whole is tasked with the Great Commission.
So you can invite your colleague to come along when you open your house. Yeah, he can tap people on the shoulder.
You can do that, yes.
Excellent. Carl, that's very helpful. Thank you for helping us think a bit about what we can do as Christians as we live in this strange new world. Can you give us a little forecast? I mean, can this keep on going? My impression is that the LGBTQ and I community and whatever else letters might come behind that is becoming less of a monolithic block.
Yes.
What's your perspective?
I think from a cultural perspective, I think transgenderism, we will see a dramatic pushback against that in the next 5 or 10 years. If you'd asked me 3 years ago, I'd have said, I'm not going to see any improvement in my lifetime. But I think we're beginning to see now significant pushback, particularly against what's called rapid onset gender dysphoria, the kind of gender dysphoria that affects young teenagers. In England, the recent CAS report essentially says that the science upon which hormone blockers, etc., have been prescribed is bogus.
Yeah.
And I think that will become more and more the accepted norm in years to come. So I actually expect significant pushback on the trans issue. I'm moderately hopeful that we may be seeing the high watermark of that relatively soon. That's not to belittle the tragedies that that involves, but it is to say that I think future generations may be better served. On the LGB stuff, well, first of all, they're falling out with the T because there are some very interesting, significant differences between them. But I'm not so hopeful there. I think that gay marriage, for example, is going to be with us for the foreseeable future. So I think Christians need to accept the fact that we are going to be regarded as marginal, strange, and extreme in our sexual codes and attitudes to sexuality. Gender, we may find, falls more back in line with traditional views.
Yeah.
But I think on the sexuality front, certainly for the next 50 to 100 years, we're not going to see significant changes.
Yeah, in a way, I think, wouldn't you say that the LGB really has a strong disagreement with the T?
Yeah.
I mean, they have a joint enemy in a way.
Yeah.
But then LGB claims we actually do have a fixed sexual identity in terms of who we are.
Yeah.
And it's just a question of whom are we drawn to, whereas the T changes that completely.
Yes, the L, the G, and the B accept and affirm what, you know, the biological sex binary of male and female.
Yeah.
And that really puts them at odds with the T. So you have strange situations in the United States where there's a British-American journalist, Andrew Sullivan, a gay journalist, who's now decried as a transphobe because he says that he's not attracted to women who claim to be men. That's transphobic.
Yeah.
So the movement is under significant strain at this particular point in time.
So I think there is some hope in that regard.
Yeah.
And ultimately, the LGB is really not that new.
No. I mean, what's new is the use of sexual desire as a fundamental point of how we think of ourselves, our identity.
Yeah.
You know, in ancient Greece, there was a lot of homosexual activity. It was a routine part of the culture. Yeah. But there weren't any ancient Greeks who identified as gay. It was just not an identity category in that sense.
Romans 1 is sometimes being taken by those who have a more liberal reading of it and saying that's not the homosexuality as we know it today. But you would disagree with that, I assume?
Yes. I think that involves a highly tendentious reading. Now, I know there are some significant debates there, but I think it involves a highly tendentious reading of Romans 1. And if you go back and set Romans 1 against Old Testament law and the trajectories coming from the Old Testament, it seems to me that you cannot, for example, say, well, Romans 1 is just referring to promiscuous homosexuals or is just referring to pederasts or something like that. I don't think that works.
Yeah. So Paul there claims that, in a way, judgment is already part of what they're doing.
Yeah.
They've been given over to.
Yes.
And you pointed out that there are some statistics that show that there's some health results that seem to actually say that's exactly true. Now, why is that not more of an issue Is that culturally, or what is behind that?
I think they're politically inconvenient truths. I was saying to somebody last night, it's interesting that tobacco is increasingly frowned upon and suppressed because it causes cancer.
Yeah.
But there are human behaviors connected to the male gay community that also cause cancer. Mm-hmm. And nobody is saying that those are, we don't deal with those with the same moral register that we deal with. Smoking tobacco is immoral now because it causes cancer.
Yeah.
When certain sexual activities cause cancer, that's a technical problem that we should to overcome through surgery or medicines or whatever.
All right. Well, any last word in terms of what should give us hope as Christians in this strange new world?
Well, I think that the promise is to the church. Jesus wins at the end. And our task is simply to be faithful witnesses to that truth in our time and our place.
And so that gives us hope because we know we're on the side of the winner.
Yeah.
And we want to get as many people as possible to find this Jesus.
Yeah.
So they will be part of the winning crew.
Yes.
And so one way we'll do that is to love even those who disagree with us, who are being misled by this new kind of thinking, or by their own desire for what the Bible calls sin.
Yeah.
And so I thank you so much for writing these books, for helping us understand where all this comes from and how to deal with that. And so thank you again for being here. Thank you for teaching us. I would highly recommend for everyone to listen to the two talks you have given, or one you're still to give today here at the Evangelium 21 conference. Karl, thank you for being here. Und zu unseren Gästen möchte ich sagen, ich hoffe, das war für euch hilfreich. Ich möchte euch sehr empfehlen, wenn ihr vielleicht das eine oder andere noch nicht so einordnen konntet, die beiden Bücher gibt es auf Deutsch, Der Siegeszug des modernen Selbst und Fremde neue Welt, wirklich sehr hilfreich, um die Hintergründe besser zu verstehen, aber auch vor allem dann beim zweiten Buch, Fremde neue Welt, zu verstehen, wie wir als Christen damit umgehen können und was wir tun können. Und ich möchte uns allen wünschen, dass wir diese Gewissheit haben, dass der Herr gewinnt, dass wir nicht Angst haben müssen, in dieser Welt zu leben, sondern dass wir eine Aufgabe haben in dieser Welt, mit Liebe und mit Klarheit Zeugen unseres Herrn zu sein. In diesem Sinne wünsche ich euch Gottes Segen und das war das Offenbargespräch mit Karl Truman.